I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. Let's talk about sex. I'm sure all of our listeners at some point in their lives have encountered an uncomfortable moment where discussing sex and sexuality. And in many places and communities within Canada, discussions of sex are still quite taboo. Today, we're definitely breaking that taboo and asking some real questions about sex in Canada. How has the subject of sex in Canada changed over time? When did issues related to sex and sexuality really undergo significant change in this country? How much sex did Canadians used to have, and how much sex are Canadians having today? These questions, and so many more, are going to be answered in the sexiest CCH episode to date, Season 9, Episode 16, Sex in Canada, Getting Busy in the Great White North. To dive to the bottom of all of these sexy questions, we've brought on an expert, sociologist Tina Fetner. Tina Fetner is professor and chair of the sociology department at McMaster University. Her previous projects have explored the dynamics of social change relating to sexuality, examining the impact of the opposing activism of LGBT movement and the anti-LGBT activism of the religious right from a historical perspective. Now, her current research examines the social organization of sexual behavior. She is the principal investigator for the Sex in Canada Multi-Method Research Project that examines sexual behavior and social attitudes among Canadian adults. This project builds upon previous work, including comparative analyses of the change in attitudes towards lesbian and gay people, as well as the uneven growth of gay-straight alliances in high schools. Now, today's recommended book is Tina Fetner's most recent. It's titled Sex in Canada, The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North. This was published by UBC Press in 2024. Now, I begin our discussion by asking Tina, how do we actually measure sexuality?
Well, there's really three kinds of ways that we understand sexuality in sociology, and two of them are much easier to measure than the third. And so it's easy to measure identity, sexual identity. We simply ask people what their sexual identity is, and they can choose the boxes, right, that we are all familiar with, heterosexual, homosexual, other. We had an open category so that people could identify in the way that was comfortable for them. The second way that we measured, which is really central to this particular survey, is sexual behavior, right? What activities are you doing by yourself or with a partner? And we have a number of questions that ask about sexual behavior on this. And then the third way that we understand sexuality is sexual desire. Right. This one is the tougher one to measure because it is like fully internal, sometimes not really easy to articulate, just the things that move us or turn us on, that make us attracted to other people or drawn to certain activities. And so this one, we kind of have to find a way to get at through proxies like behavior and identity.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And just sort of as an aside, you are doing a survey of these sort of three categories, correct? It's the Sex in Canada survey.
The Sex in Canada survey is a survey of mostly the first two, mostly survey of sexual behavior. And we ask a lot of, we ask identity questions, and we ask questions about, you know, who people are so that we can understand the social patterns of sexuality. And, you know, it may be that we want to know about the third category, about what do people really want, what is really going on. But you know, all we can do is ask, and then people can report, can say what they want, right? And one of the things that is kind of interesting is that these different kinds, these different categories don't necessarily map onto each other perfectly. Right. And so it is always the case in this survey and every other sexual behavior survey that people's, for example, sexual identity doesn't necessarily map onto their sexual behavior perfectly. This is just a consistent facet of our lives. We're more complicated than these criteria suggest.
And it's interesting because that's a really, I mean, more complicated, I think, is the at the core of this. And I think what makes this so interesting is because it's so complicated, ideas about sex have changed over time and changed dramatically over time. And I kind of want to walk through some of the sort of key concepts of sex or key ideas about sex that have undergone some change over time. And maybe we could sort of walk through several of them. So the first one that I'm kind of interested is the issue of premarital sex. How has that kind of changed, or your understanding of it has evolved?
Yeah, well, I think it's very interesting because when do you even hear the term premarital sex anymore? It's not the way we make sense of our sex anymore, but it used to be like a defining characteristic of what makes good, moral, upstanding people, the people who don't have premarital sex, right? And distinguishing them from the bad, immoral, troublesome people that are having premarital sex. And so I would say that this is a really fundamental shift in our cultural understanding of what the purpose of sex is, and moving away from a very reproductive, heteronormative understanding that sex is for making babies, and that is when it's good, right? When you're married, heterosexual, and making babies, that this is the kind of sex that we like, and everything else different from that is bad. And so premarital sex is kind of part of that package. And if you look at the attitude data over time, you see that the, which is different from the survey that I did, but if you look at that, you could see that we had really negative, intolerant, judgmental opinions about premarital sex right up until about the sexual revolution. And then, you know, in the end of the 1960s, early 1970s, we saw a dramatic sudden change in the willingness of people to judge others for that. And so it's been changing ever since. And now it's so common, people marry later in life if they marry at all. It's so common for people to be sexually active without being married that it doesn't even make sense to use this term anymore in most cases.
Well, that's actually really fascinating because, like you've said, it was sort of this, it was a hallmark of the sort of the value system of sex for so long. And after the late 1960s has, like you said, it's almost a nonsensical word in our kind of modern day lexicon. It's kind of interesting too, because premarital sex, I think, leads into the next category, which is the issue of virginity, which, boy, it has historical connotations going thousands of years back. How has, in your study and your understanding of sex in Canada, how has the issue or the topic of virginity evolved over time?
Right. Well, this also, we also have to start with a place of heteronormativity, right? The idea that we assume everybody is heterosexual and that this is just the way we organize the world. So starting from there, then you see that gender inequality is really fundamental to the concept of virginity, because you'd think that it's the, it's kind of the same thing as the prescription against premarital sex, right? You should be a virgin when you get married, and then that's how to organize your sexuality appropriately and morally. And but the gender differences in the social consequences for breaking this norm for having sex before you're married really made it very clear that this is really upholding a gender system, a gender regime as well, because what we see historically is that the very value of women in the social world was tied to their status as a virgin, right? And that if they had premarital sex, then the social consequences for that in the past were extreme, right? And not just for them, but for their family of origin, right? And so the idea of virginity as really the primary thing for middle-class white women in a kind of Victorian sensibility, you know, to a place now today where, you know, virginity has almost nothing to do with the value of women's contributions to society. I mean, maybe outside of a you know, there are a few still small religious communities that, you know, still adhere to those kinds of beliefs in our, and, you know, we have a multicultural society. And so that's still important in those communities. But the dominant kind of cultural sensibility around virginity is that it's not only is it not an inherent good thing, but that, you know, for young people, it's often seen as a stigma or an embarrassment that they have to get rid of as fast as they can.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. This shift from virginity as being this sort of mark of a chaste and pure and ideal woman of the Victorian age to the modern day concepts, where like you said, in certain maybe religious communities or smaller communities, it's still upheld, but broadly speaking, it's completely different in the way young people are thinking about virginity and responding to ideas and discussions of virginity. Or there's a gendered understanding of premarital sex and virginity, a heteronormative understanding of premarital sex and virginity in a historical sense. But then we get into masturbation. And this is something that, I mean, I think even today, there's discussions about, you know, how much do we talk about this in public? How much is this sort of part of the public consciousness when we're talking about sex? Have you seen a significant change, or have you in your research, have you seen a change over time in terms of how people talk about masturbation or think about masturbation?
I have. And this is very enjoyable for me, to somebody that talks about sexuality on a regular basis, is that as soon as my students say, oh yeah, we're all past the sex taboos, we're open to talk about everything, right, then I'll be like, okay, let's talk about masturbation. And everybody laughs, right? Yep. Because we're not yet totally comfortable with the with certain topics in sexuality. And I think this is one of them. And, you know, like, as we talk about these historical shifts, you know, one of the things that we haven't brought up yet is the role of religion.
Right.
And I think that this is, you know, fundamental to, you know, our understanding. It's fundamental to the historical shifts, right? Because it used to be that Canada was a more religious nation. It used to be that the role of the church was much more tightly coupled with the state and with sexuality-related policies. And so it was a kind of single system of sexual morality that was very closely tied to the Christian church, right, writ large. And masturbation, it, you know, you're like, what's the beef? Like, who cares? What's the problem with exploring your body and finding your way to sexual pleasure? Well, I think that the historic problem with it is that it's not reproductive, that any kind of way of experiencing sexual pleasure or having kind of any kind of carnal enjoyment that wasn't tied to kind of the central morality of church teachings was inherently wrong. And a lot of times, you know, religious teachings about masturbation included significant amounts of disinformation, right, about how harmful it was and, you know, everything from like health concerns to like, you know, mythical things like hair will grow on your palms is where the lessons that children were given.
I think what's connecting a lot of these, the discussion so far, is the issue of reproduction. So heteronormativity, reproduction, so premarital sex, virginity, masturbation, and then we get into discussions of homosexuality and, you know, an offshoot of that being the debate and discussions over same-sex marriage. And I feel like it's going to fit within some of the sort of the context that we've been discussing so far.
Well, one of the things that I that my previous expertise is on anti-gay activism of the religious right. And so this is a very interesting case. The case of same-sex marriage was really not that high on the list of lesbian and gay activists' agendas in the 1990s when this became an issue. And, you know, there was a lot of differences of opinions among, you know, lesbian and gay LGBTQ community. You know, some people wanted access to marriage, but other people really wanted a broader kind of more inclusive vision of sexual freedom that rather than just trying to mimic or create a parallel institution to what was happening in heterosexuality, wanted to really make space for people who didn't want to get married or for people who wanted to organize their sex lives outside of monogamy, et cetera, et cetera. And so because of the controversy, it really didn't rise to the top of lesbian and gay activists' agenda. It was the religious right that brought this to the agenda, that brought same-sex marriage to the agenda in the 1990s. It was because they thought that it would be a quick win for them, right? Like the threat to marriage was, and for a while there, it was really working. They got, you know, especially in the United States where their activism was the strongest, they even, you know, created all kinds of policies, not only at the state level, but even at the federal level. But then what happened on in lesbian and gay community is that a pro-marriage movement kind of emerged out in response to this anti-gay activism that was, you know, mostly made up of people who were, you know, belonged to lesbian and gay community, but weren't activists previously. But this was an issue that was important for them, especially in the United States, where your health benefits are largely tied to your access to employment. And then if you're a spouse of somebody who's employed. And so, you know, lots of people didn't have health care simply because they were kept out of the institution of marriage. And so this is a super interesting thing, the issue that was like came from the right, but then our attitudes in both the US and in Canada really shifted very suddenly and very dramatically to be in favor of it. Canadians especially saw no reason to exclude anybody from the institution of marriage. And even the right-wing activists, and you probably recall Stephen Harper kind of running on a platform of like, I'm going to reverse this decision of same-sex marriage. And then he was elected and never talked about it again. And so, you know, he knew it wasn't a winning issue and just dropped it.
Yeah, I think if I recall, and correct me if I'm maybe making this up, but I recall that there was a moment later in Harper's tenure where he basically told the conservative caucus that this was done, that the issue was over for the conservative party. They're no longer going to make this a hallmark of their agenda going forward. And I don't know, do you recall that at all, or am I just picking that up?
It's such a great example of the differences between the impact of the religious right in the US and Canada, because, you know, we have that same movement in both countries, But the impact in the US is so outsized compared to the impact in Canada. And, you know, there's complicated reasons for this that, you know, mostly related to our parliamentary system. They're not quite as, you know, the evangelical population is not as large in Canada as in the US. And so they really didn't stand a chance. And Harper was very savvy about the political context and, you know, basically said, this issue's not going to win.
Yeah. And that's a really interesting element of the Canadian political landscape and its relationship to the issue of sex. Now, there's a couple of topics, however, where the religious right has really dug their heels in, or at least has really made a hallmark of their campaigning in regards to the broad sort of subject of sex in Canada. And I think the first one, and one that is so topical, obviously with current events in the United States as well, the issue of abortion. And maybe you could walk us through how you've seen, if you have seen, a change in the way Canadians talk about and think about abortion in this country.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we had that discussion about the impact of the religious right already in the US, because I think that's really relevant here. Although I do think anti-abortion activists are a much broader range of Canadians than say religious right activists.
That's fair. Okay.
But there, as far as, you know, it always depends how you ask the question. And so we ask the question differently over time, but I would say that, you know, we ask people about their attitudes toward abortion a lot. And, you know, my assessment is that attitudes are pretty steady, at least over the last few decades, and that there is a, you know, small, you know, there's a decent sized minority of Canadians that would like to, you know, decrease access to abortion or outlaw it altogether, but they're not as large. That portion of the population is not as large as in the United States. And the political institutions of Canada so far have been much more resistant to letting a small minority of Canadians dictate the policy for everybody else. And so, you know, like it is a testament to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and to the kind of way that Canadian law and Canadian electoral politics are a bit of a more accurate reflection of the will of the people than the U.S. system, which is more varied and easy for activists to kind of grab onto power. But I think that it's been, you know, it's changed over time for depending on the window that you're talking about. But for the last 30, 40 years, I think it's been pretty steady.
And with abortion in particular, do you see correlations between what is going on in the U.S. and does that affect, like, in a very tangible way, discussions of abortion in Canada? Does that give fuel to the anti-abortion movement in Canada, or does it just sort of spark discussion and then it settles into the same pattern that you've noticed over time?
Yeah, this is exactly, you know, exactly the way to think about it. Is there's activists and supporters, right, who are looking for opportunities to make a policy change. This is true on the right as it is on the left, right? If you want something to change, the U.S. Supreme Court bringing restrictions against abortion back into reality is kind of an activist opportunity, right? It's in the news. People are thinking about it. And so, you know, yes, it's sort of fuel to the fire of activists and supporters, but it doesn't change anything about the political system or make it easier to make a policy change. And so far, there hasn't been any kind of cracks in the system that suggest that a policy change is imminent. And so I think things probably are going to stay the same in Canada.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Certainly when it captures headlines and gets people talking, but you're right. Does it change policy in this country? And it doesn't seem like
the
that.
The other thing I would point to is it does, like, you know, for particular politicians, you know, we have now a couple politicians who are, like, you know, dedicated to anti-abortion stances and, you know, make that a part of their electoral stance. And so, you know, in particular ridings, they might win because of that. But overall, is the policy going to change? It doesn't seem so right now.
And then the final sort of on this list of topics, and I think maybe because both you and I work in education, so maybe this is something that I was sort of looking forward to hearing you talk about, is the issue over sex education. And I even think about my own youth going to high school and from elementary school into high school. And I was one of the first generations. So I was born in 81, and I was one of the first generations where you really saw a much more active role in terms of sex education in both elementary and high school. And so it's just kind of fascinating to get your thoughts on how sex education has evolved in Canada over time.
Yeah. I mean, this really, you're naming the era exactly right. We had a profound shift in a public health approach in the HIV era that moved away from sexual taboos and kind of forced the issue to talk about sex frankly, to talk about safer sex, to even introduce the issue of masturbation, and to really, this is part and parcel of that shift in attitudes. And you know, perhaps you recall that this was very controversial back in the day. The U.S. Surgeon General was asked to resign because she thought that masturbation was harmless and said so in public, and this was enough to get her fired. But wow. You know, in terms of sex education, Canadians are broadly supportive of sex education. They think it's important. They think it's important that it's a valuable subject to include in the curriculum. And there's a little bit of disagreement about what the content of it should be. And that's really where the controversies come out, right?
Is it fair to say that the sexual revolution is this moment, both in Canada and North America broadly, where a lot of the issues that we've just talked about underwent dramatic changes in the way Canadians are talking about sex?
I, you know, in a word, yes.
Okay.
Right. This was it's so dramatic a shift over such a short period of time in terms of many of the attitudes changing. So we already talked about premarital sex, but, you know, attitudes about abortion started changing. And of course, in Canada, the policy shifted at this time as well. And so it was part of not just a cultural shift, but, you know, no fault divorce was introduced. Homosexuality was technically, if not, you know, in practice, you know, the illegality of it was removed from the books, although did continue to harass gay men mostly for a while after that. You know, lots of policy changes happened, but it was in response to this cultural shift. It really, the baby boom generation was, you know, reaching adulthood and riding on the wave of, you know, beatniks and whatever happened in the cultural sphere. And we just decided that, you know, the religious restrictions on our sexuality were not necessary, and we're not making our lives better.
Curious Canadian history. We'll be back after the break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Folks, I know that people out there hate when a good story gets broken up. And sometimes on CCH, our stories do get broken up. They get broken up by advertisements. And I just want to say that we rely on these advertisements to support the continuation of this show. They're very important for us. However, if you want advertisement-free CCH episodes, I have a solution for you. All you need to do is go to patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N, and join or sign up for Curious Canadian History Patreon membership. It's cheap in that you can pay $1 or $2 or $5 per episode, and you get access to advertisement-free CCH episodes. The great thing about Patreon is they have an app that you can have on your phone, so you can access CCH episodes anytime you want, just like you would on any of your podcast platforms. It's super easy to sign up, it's super safe, and it's a great way to get access to these episodes without the advertisement. So check out patreon.com/curiouscanadianhistory today. And now back to our regularly scheduled program. Because the sexual revolution is so complicated, and there's a lot of movements, and there's a lot of different things going on, depending where you are in the Canada, your relationship with the United States, your relationship with the global community of the baby boom generation, it's so complex that I think a lot of people don't understand how truly, you know, radical this period was, and so much of the specific topics that we've discussed the major changes, many of them seem to be rooted in this period. So I just find that so kind of interesting. And when we're talking about the sexual revolution, our thoughts, you know, we think of the hippie movement, right? The counterculture movement, Woodstock, you know, all these sort of iconic LA, you know, the West Coast, San Francisco, all these iconic moments or visuals. And that leads me to this question about, do you notice differences in the way Canadians approach sex versus the way Americans approach sex?
That's a really, really interesting question. And it, you know, we're so curious, right? Our cultures are so closely connected, and we, you know, experience global events in a similar way, but we do have a different political system, and we do have different policies regulating our sexuality. And so the question of what the differences are really interesting to me. And, you know, at the risk of being really boring, I feel like the biggest differences that are easiest to notice are really mostly due to the demographic differences between Canada and the US. You know, so to the extent that those matter to sexuality, I would point to religious differences, right?
Yeah, right.
And so in the United States, the evangelical identifying, you know, people who identify as evangelicals are a much larger proportion of the population than in Canada. And in both of those groups, of course, you know, one of the things that is really central to those cultures is having a very restrictive sexual morality. And I'm trying to, you know, get that morality reflected in the policies around them. And so it's not surprising that in the United States, evangelicals have been more successful at restricting sexuality through policy than in Canada. And so that also means that sexual behavior is slightly different. If you know, for all that we talk about, you know, Catholicism as a source of restrictions on sexuality, it doesn't turn out that Catholic people have sexual behavior that's any different from people who don't believe, aren't affiliated with religion at all. But evangelicals are different. They masturbate less. They have less non-reproductive sex. Like, they don't participate in oral sex to the same extent as other Canadians. And so since that's a bigger community in the US, their sexual behavior is going to be slightly different from Canada.
That's really interesting. Do you think that at the core of differences in sexual preferences, sexual identity, even differences in the way sex is talked about or thought about, is religion at the core of it?
Well, yes and no, right? So religion has been historically at the very center of sexual morality. Churches were tightly tied to state governance and were very, you know, felt very strongly about sexuality. And so mostly, I would characterize Canada as a place that came from a sexual morality that defined itself through restrictions, right? There's only one good way to have sex, and that is be heterosexual, get married, and have kids. And that's when you're allowed, and everything else is off base. But you know, with all of the loosening up of church and state, the sexual revolution coincided with a movement away from the church. So this is, you know, the 1960s is when Canada and other kinds of countries, especially in Western Europe, had a period of de-Christianization, just movement away from the church. And so this also is really central to the difference. But the other difference between Canada and the U.S. that I don't want to lose track of is really interesting as well, because, you know, we haven't had a chance yet to talk about the multicultural characteristic right. of Canada yeah. and, you know, marked especially by our French-speaking population. And so one of the delightful things to find in this survey is that people who, you know, are living in that culture have kind of different sexual behaviors than people who are living in our English-speaking culture in Canada. And so we see things like people who answered the survey in French as opposed to in English had sex more frequently than English-speaking, masturbate more frequently than English-speaking Canadians, and also had more oral sex than English-speaking Canadians. So really more and a more varied approach to sexuality. And it's really a fun and enjoyable example of the way that the culture that we engage in also turns out to be a sexual culture and shapes our sexuality in certain ways.
Were there any surprises in the survey? Maybe this element of those who answered in French being sort of having a different sexual culture than English Canada, perhaps that was a surprise. But are there regions that have, let's say, less sex than others? Or is there a region of Canada that has the least amount of sex?
There is, right? We did check it, ask for regions and tried to think through, you know, what are the social forces that would cause one region to have more sex or less sex than others. And so, you know, the biggest difference is between Quebec and other regions, mostly, as you say, because of the language difference. And then also in Quebec, there's kind of some policy differences. People don't get married as much in Quebec as the rest of Canada. But the other differences between regions are there, but they're smaller and they're not really easily mapped onto sociological explanations. And so when we find out, for example, that British Columbians have a little bit less sex than the rest of the country, it's not super easy for us to understand what's going on there. And, you know, it might just be, you know, it might just be that is what we found in this survey. If we took another survey later, it might even out. But it might be that, you know, something about the, you know, either the demographics or the culture of the population there does have a like tiny little bit of an impact on the frequency of sex that people are having.
As someone from British Columbia, that's really kind of fascinating. I'm trying to, in my head as the academic, I'm trying to like think about why that would be, but I don't think I'll ever be able to come to a good answer to that.
I tried to imagine like, is it the weather, right? But then you'd think, well, it'd be the opposite, terrain, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
You'd have maybe the people who have to deal with more storms and a winter where you're more inside, you have more opportunity to have sex. Yes. I don't know.
I don't know. That's your follow-up book, I think, is going to be time to dive in and figure that out. You know, another question I'm interested in is monogamy. Are Canadians monogamous?
Yeah, this was, you know, this is an important cultural shift. And it's an open question, you know, as there's a decline in rates of marriage, for example, and an increase in visibility of polyamorous communities. And, you know, just kind of an open question of what's the state of monogamy right now. And so I was really interested to see that, you know, large majorities of the people in this survey answered that the relationship that they were in is monogamous. And so close to 90% overall. And, you know, but of course, this isn't necessarily evenly distributed across the population. And so monogamy is much more likely to govern the relationships of straight couples than it is to to be the rules of gay men or lesbian women, even though in both of those communities, majority of relationships are monogamous as well, but just a larger proportion, right? So we have already talked about how, you know, lesbian and gay activists have fought for kind of broader sexual freedoms. And one of those is kind of sex outside of monogamy. And gay men in particular have, you know, tried to find other institutions besides marriage to govern their sex lives. And so it's not a surprise then to find that not quite 20% of gay men say that the relationship that they're currently in is open. And for lesbians are in between, they are about, I think it was about close to 10%. And straights are very low, which is one of the curious things is that straight women reported about 2% of their relationships are open, but straight men reported about 5 or 6% of their relationships are open. And so this is a curious gender difference there.
Oh, that's really fascinating. I also always thought of sex for a gay man and lesbian women as a radical revolutionary act too. I might be applying too much to it, but I feel like during the period of sort of gay liberation or queer liberation movements, you know, that sex became the sort of revolutionary act, this act of defiance to the state who was saying you can't do that or it's wrong to do that, things like that.
This was absolutely the case for gay liberationists and you know, really have also fought in court cases and tried to create kind of more expansive and more inclusive spaces for different kinds of sexuality. And so to the extent that polyamory is a new possibility for the way people can organize their relationships and their sex lives was really owing to the work that LGBTQ activists have done in the past to create that cultural space and to kind of create the policy space for it as well.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. I think that's so interesting. So I guess the big question then, and I don't even know how you answer this, but I'm just going to ask it anyways. How much sex are Canadians having?
Oh, I can answer this in several ways, and I'm happy to do so.
Please do. Please do.
If we just want to look at the broadest picture, about 70% of Canadians had sex in the past year. And so, you know, this is sometimes surprisingly low. And people are like, oh, we're only 70%. And, but if you think about your entire life course, right? You can think about it as like, okay, about 70% of my adult life will be years where I have sex. And the other 30% are years where I don't have sex, right? That kind of makes sense. Sometimes you're unwell. Sometimes you're, you know, out of a relationship or you just don't feel like it, or you're working really hard, you know? And so about 70% in the past year, about just under 50% said that they had sex with a partner in the last month. And so about half of Canadians are kind of active in a monthly basis. And then, you know, the question that people really want to know is how frequently are people having sex? What's the average amount of sex that people are having? And other scholars have looked very closely into this and find a very kind of reliable, you know, just a bit more than weekly. So about 55 or 60 times a year is the number of times average Canadians are having sex. So you can think about it as like weekly plus holidays or something like that.
Right. That's fantastic.
Special occasions and, you know, Fridays or whatever.
Right. That's great. I love the breakdown.
Well, I'm just delighted to talk about this. I think it's really important for us to find our way to a place where we can have comfortable conversations about sex, because it's all upside, right? It's like you learn more, you find out about yourself, you become a better communicator, and you can also avoid some of the uncomfortable, you know, ways that we get backed into sex that is, you know, painful or difficult. If we can talk about it, it's empowering, and I think it's for good.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find us on all your podcast listening devices. You can also find us on Acast, on Patreon, as well as on Instagram and Facebook just by searching Curious Canadian History. And folks, please do not hesitate to leave a rating and a comment wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.